Well, good morning, everyone. Well, we're in John chapter 10. It's the first time in several weeks that I've not been behind because we're a whole class behind, so we're now ready to start chapter 10. So makes me feel good anyway. I apologize. I've come down with something at the end of the week, and it hasn't gone away, but it's kind of hard to get people to teach class on short notice, and you get even further behind and so on. I thought I could muddle through as best we can here in John chapter 10. So if you'll be turning there, we'll start there in just a moment. Shall we begin with a word of prayer? God, we are amazed and awed that you are a God of such great wisdom and that you have loved and cared for us enough that you would reveal a portion of your mind to us, that we might learn to think as you think, and to be more partaking of your image, that we might more usefully serve your purpose and your cause in this world. Indeed, it is our prayer that you will be considered holy upon the earth, even as you are in heaven, that you will rule upon the earth, even as you do in heaven, and that your will, and not our own, will prevail upon this earth, even as it does in heaven. And we know, Father, that most of all, it is within our own hearts that we need to consider whether we treat you as holy and submit ourselves to your rule and do your will. And we pray we would do that this day, as always, and that we may have some better understanding because of our study this morning of the Gospel of John. It is in Christ that we pray, and amen. All right, well, chapter 10 is pretty well known as the Good Shepherd passage. In fact, the Gospel of Matthew is the most sheep-imaged passage or gospel in the entire New Testament if you cut out John chapter 10. John chapter 10 is just one of those that skews the statistics because it talks so much about sheep and shepherds and sheepfolds and so on. And that is something of an anomaly because Matthew, more than any of the other Gospels, emphasizes the shepherd role, that Israel is like sheep without a shepherd and that kind of thing. And that ties into Matthew's emphasis on Jesus as the shepherd king, the one that would come after the example and pattern of David. And to some extent, I'm certain that John intends for us to think in those terms as well here in John chapter 10. As we'll see, there's a long pedigree of imagery about sheep and shepherds throughout the Old Testament. And here we've got the events that have been happening around the Feast of Tabernacles, beginning all the way back in chapter 7. And that's gone on for some time. Jesus, of course, has portrayed himself as being this water and light, playing off the imagery of the Feast of Tabernacles. And now, you'll notice in chapter 10, verse 22, it says, "At that time the Feast of Dedication took place at Jerusalem." And if you don't know when that is, verse 23 says, "It was winter." And this is the feast that we know of more popularly today as Hanukkah. And does anyone recall what Hanukkah commemorates?
Is that Purim?
No, not the same as Purim. That's
the dedication of the temple.
Dedication of the temple. And why did it need to be dedicated? Okay, after they came back from captivity, and
the lighting of the menorah.
Okay, lighting of the menorah is part of that. There is a particular event. It is the Maccabean period. Yeah, so it's a portion of the biblical history that's only recorded for us prophetically in the book of Daniel. You remember that. Of course, after Alexander the Great's empire disintegrated, it was divided up amongst various Greek rulers, and the Seleucids were in control of Palestine in the second century before Christ. And Antiochus Epiphanes decided to outlaw being a Jew. It wasn't a racial thing. The intent was to get all the Jews to become Greeks, to change their cultural identity. And those that didn't would be put to death. And he came pretty close to, I think he came much closer than Hitler did in terms of a final solution. But there were a few faithful, and as part of the atrocities of the Seleucids, they had sacrificed a pig on the altar in Jerusalem. Now, it wasn't like they said, well, let's find the most offensive thing we can and sacrifice it on the Jewish altar. Pigs were just a very common sacrifice for Zeus. It just added to the insult, of course. And so the temple had been defiled. And when the Maccabees had attained some degree of political, military success, they retook the city of Jerusalem and rededicated the temple. And so they commemorated that here. And the business with the menorah was supposedly they only had enough oil to keep the menorah lit for like one day, I think, and then it lasted all week. And so that was considered a sign from God, that kind of thing. Well, as you might imagine, that was a very significant event in the history of Israel and one they would commemorate. And so it's referred to here. And it is, Hanukkah is roughly around Christmas time. So you have a pretty rough idea of when it occurs. And so that's the time that these events are taking place here. And so Tabernacles is typically back in October. So a couple months have passed. And so you'll notice that John, in the way he's telling his story, I guess it's possible years have passed, kind of thing between these events. But it seems like John, of all of the gospel writers, particularly slows down and emphasizes certain events, and particularly the things that are said, the kind of conversation that goes on that gives you the commentary about what's happening. And so here John has been really dwelling upon this series of events that have happened during this very short time period. Some other connections that we see here, again, verse 20 and 21, many of them were saying, "He has a demon and is out of his mind. Why do you listen to him?" And others were saying, "These are not the sayings of one demon-possessed. A demon cannot open the eyes of the blind, can he?" Well, I don't know whether demons can or not. I suspect they wouldn't want to. But this is continuing a theme that we've also seen from chapter 7, that Jesus is accused of having a demon as well as being a Samaritan, you'll recall. So that came up in chapter 7, repeated in chapter 8, and still being repeated here. And as we just read, there's reference again to the healing of the blind man on the Sabbath day from back in chapter 9. And so it's very similar to what we had earlier. Jesus had healed the lame man on the Sabbath day in chapter 5, and they were still talking about it a year later. And Jesus refers to that in chapter 7. Now here the blind man's been healed, a man who had never seen. He had been born blind, and that was extraordinary. And they're still talking about that here. And now that's, just a couple months later, so that's not that surprising. But as far as the story is being told to us, this makes an important connection here between these sections. And really what I'm wanting us to think about is, I think we mentioned this back when we started the Gospel of John, chapters 11 and 12 are something of a transition, a bridge to get us from what is in essence the introduction to the gospel, because the real gospel story is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And that'll begin in earnest in chapter 13 with the Passover meal Jesus has with his disciples, and he washes their feet, and he'll be arrested that night and crucified the next day, and so on. And so all of this is just kind of preparatory to that end. And it's chapters 11 and 12 that form the bridge between these two sections. And, of course, chapters 11 and 12 are the most noteworthy thing that happens is the resurrection of Lazarus. And this is the, in one sense, it's the conclusion of the preparatory material, because it's the final climactic miracle or sign that Jesus does that points to who he is and what his work is all about, at least up until the greatest sign of all, which is Jesus' own resurrection, of course. And it's also preparatory to his own death, because, as we will see with the story of Lazarus, of course, the authorities haven't been happy with Jesus all along. They've actually plotted his death on several occasions. But it is the actual raising of Lazarus from the dead that is the final straw that breaks the camel's back. This is, there's no turning back. We're absolutely going to deal with this man, and we're going to kill him. And it's just a matter of finding the best time to do that, the best way to go about doing that. So, chapter 10, then, is going to bring us up to this kind of end point. We're going to see at the end of the chapter, Jesus, in essence, retires from his public ministry. It's not that Jesus doesn't do things in public anymore, but his ministry is over as we typically understand that. He's not just going around preaching to people, traveling from village to village and that type of thing. From this point on, he withdraws from the public eye, and only those events that explicitly lead up to his death are we told about or see him engaging in, which includes the raising of Lazarus from the dead, which again is going to be the event that precipitates everything that's going to follow. And so in that, what role does chapter 10 have? How is it connected with all this stuff that we've seen before? And one of the central elements here that John is wanting to return to, it's been kind of there all along, because you see the hostility and the opposition of the religious leaders to Jesus. But this is going to be developed now more explicitly, and it lays the groundwork for understanding why, although Jesus is the Messiah, he is rejected by his people and put to death. And so that's an important element to develop here. And so we're going to see this done through the imagery of the shepherds. And so ultimately it explains the rejection of Jesus, because that's what's going to begin in earnest now in chapter 11. And we mentioned way back in the prologue, the first 18 verses of chapter 1, that one of the difficult things that John wants to address is, how do you explain the fact that if Jesus really is the Messiah and everybody was expecting the Messiah, why didn't they embrace Jesus when he came? And he's not the kind of Messiah they were looking for, and so they have rejected him. But that's the pattern. They've always rejected God and his ways, and never really understood what God was doing. And so Jesus is really no exception to that. All right, those are kind of introductory things to say. Any, I don't know, questions or comments that you might have of a general nature? All right, well, let's look at the text here. Basically, the first 18 verses deal with this imagery, parable of the Good Shepherd, some people would call it. But it really breaks down into three different things that Jesus talks about. In verses 1 through 6, we have the parable of the sheepfold. That's really the focus of this imagery. Then verses 7 through 10, the doorway or the gate to the sheep. And then verses 11 through 18, the Good Shepherd. And so they're related images, but different points are being made along the way. And then beginning of verse 19 and following, you get some of the response of the authorities to what Jesus is doing here. Now, to appreciate this business about shepherds, there, of course, is the background that comes to us from the Old Testament. Numbers chapter 27, when Moses' successor is being chosen. It turns out it's going to be Joshua, right? And what's the importance of that? Okay, it was one of the 12 spies. Okay, so Jesus' Hebrew name actually was Joshua, so to speak. So there's a connection. Of course, that's one of those quirky things that's been lost to us because we have an English name in two different forms, kind of like James and Jacob. A lot of people don't know that's the same name, and just quirky. The point that is made there is that Israel needs somebody to lead Israel in and out, take them out to pasture, bring them into safety. And, you know, without such leadership, they're like sheep without a shepherd. And so God is raising up Joshua to be that kind of shepherd, kind of in imitation of Moses. And so that language of God leading his people out and in, like a shepherd taking care of his people, is a very common one that we're going to find throughout the Old Testament. And then one that ought to be familiar to us from our recent auditorium study in Jeremiah. In chapter 23, the self-serving, wicked shepherds of Israel, particularly of Judah in the case of Jeremiah, just leaders, they could be the priests, could be the aristocracy, the members of the royal household, the elders of the people, various ones. Ezekiel 34 is a more extended treatment of this same topic, same imagery. Here you have two prophets from the same time period, Jeremiah in Judah, Ezekiel in captivity off in Babylon. But this has been one of the real problems that Israel has faced. It's not that bad leadership absolves the sheep, you know, from being what they ought to be, but it certainly is a big contributing factor, and the shepherds themselves will be indicted by God and brought under God's judgment. And if we have time, there's a lot of things we could say about Ezekiel 34. One of the most intriguing things to me is when you start the chapter, God, you know, says in essence, the shepherds have not done their job. They've, you know, fattened the sheep to slaughter them for their own selfish means. They've not taken care of the sick. They've not gone and hunted for the lost, and so on. And God's just disgusted with this. He's done with it. And he says, I myself will shepherd my people, and I will feed them, and I will lead them in and out, and, you know, so on and so forth. And so after this whole emphasis that God's done delegating this role of shepherding out to these rotten people who don't do a good job, he's going to have to do it himself. He then says, I will appoint David as their shepherd. And you just scratch your head and you say, well, what was all this rigmarole about, you know, God's going to be the shepherd and God's going to do all this because no one else is up to it. And then he turns right around and says, I'm going to make David their shepherd. And of course, David's been dead for, you know, 400 or 500 years, right? So how do we make sense of this? Okay, Samuel promised that the line of David would, there was a seed of David who was going to reign on God's behalf, right? And of course that was Solomon or Hezekiah, but ultimately, you know, Jesus is the one the Bible points us to. And so here's this paradox in which you have somebody who is the seed of David and a human being according to the flesh, but he's also the Son of God. He's none other than God himself. And so it turns out that David, not David literally, but this descendant of David, shepherds God's sheep, but it's also God himself doing it because they're one and the same person. But who would ever have thought that? You know, who would ever have figured that out by reading Ezekiel 34? You just say, I don't know what this means. You know, again, yeah, maybe God is going to delegate it to somebody else, but this time somebody who's going to do a better job or something like that. That doesn't really fit the emphasis in chapter 34 that God himself is going to be taking care of his people directly. And so here is how he goes about fulfilling that. And you see passages like Romans chapter 1 making this point, you know, that Jesus was declared to be the Son of David according to the flesh, but declared to be the Son of God by the power of the resurrection. And so he is both, astoundingly. But that comes from Ezekiel chapter 34. Isaiah has his own text in which he indicts the shepherds of the people of his day as being blind watchmen and blind shepherds. Zechariah chapter 11 is a passage that's familiar to us because it gets applied to Jesus, the 30 pieces of silver that turn out to be the betrayal price of Judas, of course, and that's one of the connections between the text here in Zechariah. But the point is that a shepherd has been raised up for God's people, and he's been rejected. And here it appears in the original context of Zechariah that Zechariah is the shepherd. He's the prophet, and he's been trying to guide God's people, but they haven't listened, and you know they don't have much use for him. And so God tells Zechariah, "You tell the people, now you just pay me what you think I'm worth, and then I'll go my way. You know, they pay me for the job that I've done." And so you kind of get the impact of this. It would be like if you had a gospel preacher come in here and hold a meeting, and all week long, you know, preaching this, that, and the other. And then he said, "Now, the only amount of money I want you to pay me is what you think this meeting was worth." And then, you know, Adam writes him a check for 3 cents. He says, "Here you go. Thank you for the week of gospel preaching." And what would we consider that?
Chintzy.
Chintzy. Yeah. I mean, it's even beyond chintzy, isn't it? I mean, it'd be better to give you nothing, right? Than to, you know, it's like leaving a tip, you know. If you don't leave a tip, maybe that person just forgot or they have some kind of scruples about leaving tips or something. But when they leave a tip of, you know, 2 cents or something, it's like, they're making a statement, you know. You're not worth anything. It's an insult, an intended insult. And that's the point here in Zechariah 11. We don't value what you've done. We think, 30 pieces of silver, that's a lot of money. No, it's not. So that was the insulting price that was put on Zechariah as a prophet and on Jesus as, the God himself come to the earth. Isaiah 40 is another well-known sheep image to us. That not that it's such a prominent passage on its own, that if somebody had just read through the Old Testament and, you know, when you make a list of sheep passages, that's got to be Isaiah 40. Because there are a lot of others like Psalm 23, obviously, which I didn't even put down here. But Isaiah 40 is significant because it has already been used in reference to John the Baptist as the one, the voice crying in the wilderness, make a way for God, you know, to come to his people. And so the fulfillment of Isaiah 40 is this prophet, this messenger who's announcing the coming of God to his people. And he comes as a shepherd, carrying the, you know, lamb in his arms. You know, we've all seen famous pictures of Jesus carrying the lamb. And yet, it's also Isaiah, because so much emphasis is given to Isaiah 53, and we're going to see that even here in the Gospel of John a little bit later, that the shepherd actually becomes one of the sheep. And like a sheep led to the slaughter, he is sacrificed, not for his own misconduct, but for the good of the nation as a substitute sacrifice. And then the passage that Lawson mentioned, 2 Samuel chapter 7 in particular, and a lot of other Old Testament passages that allude back to the promise that God made to David that he was going to raise up a shepherd like David that would shepherd his people and guide them and so on. So we got a whole lot of imagery here. Jesus as the seed of David would be the ultimate fulfillment of this shepherd role. Prior to this, we have a lot of bad shepherds, people who fail to lead and guide the people the way that they should. All right, so as we said, we break down this imagery to the parable of the sheepfold, first of all. And the point of this is that you picture a small village somewhere in which a lot of different people in the area have flocks, and they can pool their resources to put them all in one enclosure for the night, and that would protect them. And so in the morning, when you would go out, you would call out your sheep. You know, it wouldn't make any sense, you know, that you've got one pen that only has your sheep in it. It'd just be, those are all your sheep. But you have a picture envisioned where there are a lot of different flocks mixed together. And, you know, George has got his in there. And when George comes, he says, "Hey, y'all, come on." And his sheep know him, and they will come out the gate and follow him and go wherever he leads them. And the other sheep say, "We don't know who that is," or whatever, however sheep talk. There are many flocks mixed kind of up in this one sheepfold. Now, I've given you a picture here of a sheepfold. These are very common in the Middle East, where, you know, if you've kind of cleaned out your ground for planting or even pasture, and you got a lot of rocks, you know, well, you want to get those rocks out of the way. So what do you do with them? Well, you make walls out of them, and you'd make a wall around a vineyard or, you know, whatever, any other kind of enclosure you want to make. And so making sheep enclosures out of these rocks is very common. So you make a big circle, and you leave an opening, obviously, where the gate would be. And often you would even put brambles on top of the rock wall. And what purpose would that serve? Okay, so that's your ancient equivalent to razor wire or barbed wire on top of the fence, right? And so that would be a kind of an effective deterrent. And here, clearly, Jesus is telling the story directed against the religious authorities. So notice verse 6, John chapter 10, verse 6. "This figure of speech Jesus spoke to them, but they did not understand what those things were which he had been saying to them." And so we don't really have to think a lot or figure out, well, what exactly is Jesus talking about, because it tells us that it really is about the leadership of Israel, and it contrasts the failed leadership of the current religious authorities versus Jesus' own leadership. And then the next two that are going to follow have to do with the gateway to the sheep and the shepherd himself. But the thing I want to warn us about is, don't try to take all these symbols and make them fit from one to the other. You know, let the shepherd always has to be the one thing, the gate always has to be one thing, the sheep always have to be one thing. Picture a preacher getting up and saying, "Well, let me use an illustration about sheep," and you can talk a little bit and make a point. And say, "Well, while we're on the subject of sheep, you know, there's also this over here," and you develop that point, but they don't have to necessarily be consistent with one another. And so we'll point that out as we go through here, for example. So let's look at verses 1 through 5. "Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the door into the fold of the sheep, but climbs up some other way, he is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is a shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he puts forth all his own, he goes ahead of them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. A stranger they simply will not follow, but will flee from him because they do not know the voice of strangers." Well, who's the doorkeeper here? You know, and who or what is the gate? that the doorkeeper operates? Who are all these shepherds? And so on. Well, again, we're going to come down a little later. Jesus is going to claim to be the door to the sheep, the gateway that, you know, one must go through. Do we try to bring that later image and put it into this earlier one here, and that the doorkeeper is the Holy Spirit or something, you know, that operates Jesus? I don't think that's the point. Here, it's just a simple illustration that if you picture the world as being one big sheepfold and all these different flocks are in it, and not all of these sheep belong to Jesus. You know, some of these sheep are listening to the voices of other shepherds. But the only ones that are going to follow the one shepherd are those sheep that belong to him. And this kind of ties in with what we had talked about a few weeks ago, a question that Dan had asked. You know, this business that John has emphasized that God has already called certain people before they're Christians. There's some sense in which we already belong to God and are his people before we ever hear the gospel. And again, that's going to come up here in this language that's used here. There is some sense in which people must be prepared and ready to hear the voice of Jesus and to follow him. And there are some people that just won't. Jesus is a complete stranger. They don't recognize his voice. They won't listen to him. And they will never follow him. And so again, what is this that people need? What is it that separates those who hear the gospel and reject it from those who hear the gospel and accept it? And I don't think we need to have recourse to some mystical, miraculous operation of the Holy Spirit or anything like that. But there has to be, in some sense, an already a moral preparedness and a willingness that when they hear that message, there's something that, you know, is a ring of truth to it. It's just like, yes, that's what I've been looking for this whole time. You know, that's what I've been seeking without knowing it, but now I finally found it. And I think that's what Jesus is picturing here. And so by contrast, he's a legitimate shepherd who comes to call his sheep, and he's not one of these thieves and robbers that, you know, climbs up over the wall. And of course, a thief and a shepherd, his only interest is in, you know, stealing the sheep and, you know, slaughtering them to eat and, you know, things like that. But he's a good kind of shepherd. Now, he hasn't made that point yet more explicitly. So then when you come to verse 7, he says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." And so now he's affirming that he, in fact, is the gateway that controls access of going out and coming in, that all other shepherds are imposters, you know. Now, the imagery we had before was lots of flocks mixed together, and any shepherd that came and called his sheep, they would follow him. Now the imagery's changed a little bit, that there is only one real shepherd, those that are truly his sheep, they won't listen to the voice of these false shepherds. The only thing they have done is they've suffered at the hands of the thieves that have stolen them and killed them and destroyed them. But he is the only one that brings true life to them. And I think that's why this imagery has changed here a little bit, because, you know, you could take that first image and say, well, this is the state of world religion. Muhammad comes and he's a shepherd, and he calls to his sheep, and those are Muslims, you know, and they find happiness and satisfaction in their religion. And, you know, Buddha calls his sheep and they listen to his voice, and Jesus is just one among many shepherds. Well, again, you start with a basic illustration, but then it gets narrowed down that Jesus is the only shepherd. And that coincides with what we've seen emphasized through the book, Again, probably the clearest claim is yet to come in chapter 14. No one can come to the Father but by me. You know, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the gateway that everyone will pass through. You cannot go out or come in except to pass through Jesus. And what that is affirming, of course, is that there may be other sheep in this world, but none of them are finding pasture. None of them are finding security because they do not go out and they do not come in. Well, again, the analogy kind of breaks down a little bit. You say, well, where are they then? They've got to be somewhere. No, that's not the point of the parable. The idea of going out and coming in is finding what it is you need as a sheep. Going out and finding food, coming in and finding security. And the fact is, nobody can provide that for anybody in this world except Jesus. Jesus is the only true shepherd that will allow for the sheep to find what it is they really need and to come back in and find what it is that they need. And so he uses the example of being the gateway that controls that access of who goes in and who comes out and finds salvation, ultimately, as we would say. And everybody else that claims to be a shepherd is nothing but a thief and has done nothing but to destroy and kill the sheep. And so then that emphasizes, of course, Jesus as the means of entry into the kingdom. And then he rounds it off by making the claim, I am the good shepherd. And then he says something most extraordinary. And he says, the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Now, what's the problem with that statement? Okay, the good shepherd should be willing to lay down his life for the sheep, but by no means do you want to die, because if you do die in the process of trying to save your sheep, you're not going to save your sheep. The wolf kills you, and now it's just open, you know, season on the sheep, right? So doesn't make any sense. A dead shepherd doesn't do sheep any good. But certainly the shepherd puts himself in danger, and he you know it's just like anybody that puts their life in danger to try to save somebody. In most situations, you don't do that knowing you're going to die. You know you might die, but you're willing to take the risk in hopes of saving this person, and that is very heroic and very noble. And it would be even more extraordinary when a person knows they're going to die and they do it anyway. You know, often the way that works out is the person is willing to endanger themselves, but they fail to save the person in the process. They both die. You know, that happens often. So how many situations can you think of where someone actually dies in the process of saving somebody else, and it was only through their death, not the risk of death, but death itself, that they could save the other person? I mean, it's hard to even imagine such a scenario, but that's what we have with Jesus.
In war, when a soldier throws himself on a grenade.
Right. But even then, you know, there have been some people that have survived that, you know, remarkably, you know. Or you hope it's a dud, you know, or something like that. But people certainly are willing to do that. And that's what's commendable as far as the sacrificial attitude and so on. And, of course, in that scenario, you know, the loss of the one soldier doesn't put all of the others at risk, the way the shepherd being killed by the wolf will. So, of course, all this is the paradox that, you know, normally the decent shepherd has to risk his life in order to protect the flock, but he actually has to stay alive in order to succeed at protecting them. I guess maybe we could picture a shepherd that, you know, goes hand-to-hand combat with a wolf and they both die, you know, and so the sheep are spared until some wandering person comes along and finds them and takes them in or something. But here, of course, Jesus is going to make the point. He intentionally lays down his life, and that's the only way the sheep are going to be saved. And so it's, again, one of these paradoxes. It makes as much sense to the Jews as this does with sheep and shepherds. You know, dead shepherd is no good. Dead Messiah, no good. What Jew in their right mind is going to believe in a crucified Messiah? That doesn't make any sense. And so they're pretty sure that can't be right. And so that's the kind of way in which Jesus gets dismissed and why he is rejected by his own people. So the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And again, they would have heard that. He risks his life, but Jesus means by it something even more than that, we know. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who's not the owner of the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he's a hired hand and is not concerned about the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me, even as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep which are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will hear my voice, and they will become one flock with one shepherd. For this reason, the Father loves me, because I lay down my life so that I may take it again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down. I have authority to take it up again. This commandment I received from my Father. And I take it that's probably rooted in a lot of the same things that are discussed back in chapter 5, that Jesus only does what the Father shows him because the Father loves him, and that the Father has given all power that ultimately is manifest in the power of judgment and the power of life and death, and that Jesus possesses that. So he has power even over his own life to lay it down and to take it up again. And of course, who are these other sheep that Jesus has?
Christians.
Okay, Christians. Gentile Christians in particular, probably. You know, if you talk to Jehovah's Witnesses, it's the 144,000 sheep and then the multitude that'll live on planet Earth forever. But I think probably here Jesus is picturing the idea that among the Jewish people, there are those that will hear the voice of Jesus and come out from among them and look upon him as their shepherd and as the sole way of finding God and salvation and going out and coming in. But there are some other sheep that he has come to call as well, and there are those among the Gentiles who will come out, and they will all be one flock then. And so there's an emphasis upon the unity of God's people and the irrelevance of whether they're racially Jewish or a Gentile. And this is the point at which people say, hey, this guy's just crazy. Why would anyone listen to him? And others were willing to give him a more sympathetic hearing, of course. All right, well, very quickly, this leads into the Feast of Dedication and the events that happen. Now, it might sound like, well, we've just changed from the subject of sheep to something else. But that, in fact, is not the case. Come on down to verse 26, 27. You do not believe because you're not of my sheep. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me, and I give eternal life to them, and they will never perish, and no one will snatch them out of my hand. So even here with the teaching that Jesus is doing in the temple associated with the Feast of Dedication, is still this imagery and language of the sheep and so on. Well, you think, well, what's the imagery of the Feast of Dedication? Well, it's about the dedication of the temple. So it brings us back to this image of Jesus as the true temple of God, the true dwelling place of God. That, again, was really the primary emphasis or connection with the Feast of Tabernacles, to commemorate coming to the promised land and dwelling there securely, and what symbolizes their secure dwelling in the promised land more than a permanent temple for God there in the land. And so Jesus represents this ultimate fulfillment of the temple And so that's something they should be thinking about in connection with the Feast of Dedication. In this, he is emphasizing the fact that he has been revealed to them as the Messiah because of the testimony. Again, verse 24, "How long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Messiah, tell us plainly." And Jesus said, "I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, these testify of me. But you can't hear, you can't see it, because you're not of my sheep and will not hear my voice. But if you were of my sheep and would hear my voice, you would know these things, believe these things. My Father who has given them to me," again, there's some sense in which we've already been given to the Father, the Father has given us to Jesus. "He is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one." And then at this point, they want to stone him. And he says, "Well, why are you going to stone me?" "Well, for blasphemy. We don't stone you for doing a good work, but for blasphemy, because you, being a man, make yourself out to be God." And then this leads to this whole discussion that stems from the Psalms. We'll have to save that for next week, unfortunately. So be thinking about that. What is the nature of this argument that Jesus makes? I said they are gods, and so, what connection does that have with Jesus claiming to be the Son of God and so on? Well, we'll come back and talk about that next week. Any final comments, questions? Well, it just remains for us to go out and think of Jesus as our good shepherd and what that really means. It's not just a warm, cuddly figure of speech. It really reminds us of the authority of Christ and our need to listen to him and to submit to his will. And only in that way will we really find what it is we're looking for in this life. So, well, thank you for your kind attention. And we'll continue on and look ahead into chapters 11.